You are listening to Let's Talk. I am Dr. Hassan Batts, and I'm here with Phyllis Alexander, a consultant for liberation. But I would say most importantly, or more importantly, one of my favorite people in the whole wide world. Phyllis, you are a mother to me. You are a sister to me. You are a friend to me. You are a mentor. You are someone that is family and in the inner circle. And I'm excited to be on this call with you and to share you and your story and your dreams and your experiences with the world. Welcome to Let's Talk, Phyllis.
Thank you. Thank you. I should start each day like this. This is great. I have a big, big, big smile on my face.
Listen, those are the affirmations you have to start the day with. You have to look in the mirror and say a few words that'll put a smile on your face every single day.
I know, but I haven't really been able to be consistent with a ritual. So thank you. Thank you.
So this episode is my gift to the world, right? I want to share one of my people with mm-hmm. them. So tell the world, who is Phyllis Alexander?
Well, you know, it occurs to me that whenever I introduce myself, I always have to spell my name, because I say, this is Phyllis Alexander. I have a Midwestern accent, so people are always like, Phyllis, Alice, what you say? So I always have to go, this is Phyllis Alexander, P-H-Y-L-L-I-S. And I think that is a metaphor for how I've had to navigate life, that I've had to recognize that people don't understand who I am. They have some stereotypical notion of who a dark skin, short hair, African-featured female is. And so I'm constantly navigating, being, explaining, and showing up in my true self. First, I have to reclaim my true self because I was tainted by the misinformation out there about who I am. So I had to reclaim it, name it, explain it, show it, be it. So that's who Phyllis Alexander is, someone who goes through life being as clear as she can possibly be about who she is so that people are not confused. You know, I don't want people thinking that my name is Phyllis. You know, my name is P-H-Y-L-L-I-S, and that's how I have to do life. This is who I am. This is how I feel. This is what I think, blah, blah, blah. So that's who I am.
That's beautiful. I mean, you're claiming your space and making sure that they get it right, right? And part of the season that we're in is rewriting the narrative. So you identified yourself as a liberation consultant or consultant for liberation.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? And mm-hmm. how did you get there? Like, let's talk about mm-hmm. the Phyllis Alexander journey. So today mm-hmm. we'll talk about who you are. You can either start from who you are today or you can start from how did mm-hmm. you get to who you are today. It's up to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, what comes to mind is to go from how I got here. And, you know, I'm an elder. And so a long, 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 long time ago, I went to high school. And you've heard this story. I had a white male teacher who was a history teacher, and so he taught us current events. And a long, long, long time ago, there was a civil rights movement going on, and I came from a family that believed education was the antidote to racism.
Okay.
And so my mother told me, go to school, pay no attention to the civil rights stuff going on. You learn, get good grades, because they really felt that education would save me, right? Education would protect me from racism.
Protect you from racism?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Education was going to protect me from racism.
Wow. I don't mean to laugh. I mean, you know, it's easy for me to look back, you know, in retrospect and be like, damn, education. You need more armor than that. You need a couple swords and some other things.
We know that now.
That's
but my parents were like, graduate from high school. And then this was during the era where going to college for black folks was becoming a thing.
Mm.
And so go to college, get a degree. And at that time, it was like, you get a bachelor's degree, you can write your ticket. You know, you're going to be anything you want to be. So anyway, I listened to that. And, you know, when you're a child, you're selective. You know, some things you listen to, some things you don't. I chose to listen to that because it didn't cost me nothing. It's like, you know, okay, I won't get involved. But then my history teacher was teaching us about what was happening right then and in that moment. And I watched black folks somewhere in the South being literally washed down the street for fire hoses. I don't know if you remember that history.
Of course.
But the resistance to our choosing to be liberated was to pull out the fire hoses on us and try to wash us down the street. I was done. I was like, what? And in that moment, I became someone that sought my liberation. And over the years, I have evolved to how to do that, who to do that for, and all of the things. And so I used to do it in a particular way that was shaming and blaming, and I've evolved from that. I used to do it for folks of white race identity, trying to get my liberation through trying to teach them to be less racist. I've evolved from that. And so currently I continue to be on a journey of getting my own liberation. You know, I always have to go back to that. I didn't learn that until a long, long time ago, that I needed to seek my own liberation. And then I've evolved into primarily working with folks who are black, Latino, Asian, indigenous, working with that group to facilitate liberation within my folks.
Mm. And how's that going? I hope that's a hopeful laugh.
Woo! The struggle is real.
Yeah. And I mean, let's talk about that, right? When you say the struggle is real, what's at the forefront right now? What are the people that you're in relationship with waking up and feeling? What's keeping them up at night? What's keeping you up at night?
What's at the forefront? I feel like you have something in mind. What's on the forefront with you? Why are you asking this question? I feel like you got something in mind.
No, I didn't necessarily have anything in mind, but as I asked it, the election came to mind. But that wasn't my intention for asking it, right? My intention was that you're doing this work, you're in relationship with people, and some of those relationships, deep relationships, and people that are being marginalized and sometimes living in fear. So I was wondering, is there anything in particular? You know, I mean, the economy continues to come up in the communities that I serve, but for the black women I'm in relationship with, this election and reproductive rights and racism and for the people that I serve that are immigrants are terrified. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't mm-hmm. know. I don't know mm-hmm. if I initially mm-hmm. asked it with an answer, but I'm developing mm-hmm. one as I think through it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Hey, I'm supposed to be the interviewer here.
But it felt like a question that was on your mind. So let's see, what's on the forefront?
Yeah, what are the themes that...
It doesn't change. It does not change. It is our woundedness. Mm. We are a wounded people. Mm. And so, of course, the election heightens the woundedness. It's like, damn, they really don't think we're human. Mm. They are willing to throw us under the bus. I mean, white women figured out how to vote for reproductive rights in different states while at the same time vote for Trump.
Say more about that.
I mean, well, according to the data, there are several states that have reproductive rights on the ballot.
Oh, understood. Okay.
And white women were able to go, yep, I'm going to vote for my reproductive right, but I'm going to vote for Trump. And I get that that means I'm throwing immigrants, black people, you know, all I'm voting for me. Mm. That's what white women said. I am voting for me. And damn anybody else.
That's a harsh assessment. Some of my listeners are not going to be happy about that.
Well, they know who they are. And the women who didn't know who they are. Mm. But I think it was 51% of white women. They voted for them. Damn the rest of us.
So you're saying, let me get this right, that people should not vote in their best interest. They should think about a collective best interest. And we're talking
Absolutely.
About decision. We're not just talking about just voting. I don't think you can say that on the air. My producer shot me a look like, you know, this is not Death Row Records. I don't know. But I give him
some work.
But that's how passionate you are about this, because you traditionally do not curse. So absolutely, you should not just vote and make decisions in life based on your own best interest.
Absolutely. I mean, that's called civilization, where you do what's best for the group, in my opinion.
Okay.
If we're all only out for ourselves, that, I believe, leads to savagery.
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 And then yet we live in a country, I would say, that is focused on hyper-individualism, right? Like
savagery. See, you know how this country was built. Savagery.
You're calling a thing a thing. Like, you're getting straight to the point. That's the blessing of being an elder, right? You don't have to use euphemisms or any of that.
I don't even know another word. I mean, that's the only... It's not like I'm trying to parse my words. I don't have another word.
So for those that will deny that, or their minds rejected, or is this some cognitive dissonance, give us the 60-second definition and connection between why you say this country is founded on savagery.
Now, you know, good and doggone well, to come to a country and commit genocide to the people who were in the space that you now want to be in, I don't see what else you call that. Indigenous people were here. Folks came over. They said, oh, we want to be here. Indigenous people said, well, maybe we can figure out how to share this. The whole Thanksgiving thing is about sharing food and whatnot. And then folks that came over here were like, no, that's not enough. We want it all.
I think they called it Manifest Destiny is what it was called.
It could be called that. I've heard of that.
Yeah.
They had a particular point of view. If I want it, I can have it. And then they want to act like God sanctioned that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they did all kinds of savage things to get this land. Then they went to the continent, and, you know, because it's like, we're not going to work the land. You know, and so then they did all kinds of savage things to bring folks over from Africa to work the land. Now, I get that Africans participated to varying degrees and giving up our people. I get that. I get that slavery has happened before it happened here in the United States. But I believe chattel slavery is a new and unique thing to the United States. So, savagery.
Mm. Okay, so you explained that one for me. The other thing I need you to explain a little more is, you said our people are wounded, and I'm concerned about how that's going to hit certain people. So what does that mean, our people are wounded?
Well, I can talk about my wounds. I remember, again, long, long, long time ago, I decided I wanted to have an afro.
Mm-hmm.
And so I stopped with the, I think I did press and curl. You know, my mom did a hot comb, straightening, burning my ears, burning my neck, all of that. So I shifted from wearing my hair straight, went to a natural look. My favorite aunt in the entire world, my favorite aunt Gert, looked at me and said, why would you deliberately make yourself ugly?
Wow. How old were you?
14, 15.
Mm.
Because I'm wearing my hair natural, in its natural state. And that was, she loved me.
That's right.
Dr. Batts. She loved me. She made her love for me clear. I'm not like, I think she loved me.
That's right.
She loved me. And that was her response when I came out with my natural. Why would you make yourself deliberately ugly? That is a manifestation of her woundedness, which did not just kind of go over my head. So I have lived a life, I mentioned, dark skin, short hair, African features. I have felt ugly. You've heard me say this.
Mm-hmm.
So I've gone through life feeling ugly, even when I make decisions that are consistent with my natural appearance, I'm constantly battling that thing within that says, I don't have straight hair, I don't have blue eyes, I don't have white skin.
Because that's the epitome of beauty.
because that is the epitome of beauty. I can remember as a child, because I wanted to have the experience of hair moving on my head, moving across my shoulders, of putting some tights on my head so that the leg of the tights were moving back and forth.
Wow.
I can remember my sister, who I shared a room with one night, very quietly saying to me, "I wish I were white."
And where do those wounds come from? Because that's deep, to look in the mirror and to wish you were something else or you look different.
Right. Well, you got to read The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison, which is on the banned list here in Tennessee. See, that's the book that explains that. But they have banned that book. They don't want us to even know the origin of our irrationality.
I was having a conversation with someone, and I was saying that's a fairly new concept, that the only place that I've experienced banned books is in prison. And a lot of people don't know that. There's always been banned books in prison. You can't read a book like the autobiography of Malcolm X. Anything that's going to liberate your mind, yeah, you can't read. And as I was saying it, what came to my mind was we come from a people where all books were banned, where you would be killed for reading. So this is not new to us. Our ancestors, not too long ago, probably your great-grandmother, would have been killed for reading.
Well, you know, you're right. You know, you are right. They even created a whole new Bible for us to read as slaves, you know, the slave Bible. They wouldn't allow us to read their version of the Bible, which had some presumably passages in there about liberation and freedom and all those kind of good things. So, yes, banned books is not
new. You were going to touch on everything controversial that you can find to touch on. Well, it was nice having this show while it lasted, you know, because I might get banned from radio.
I don't mean no harm.
Okay. So I often say I was born into a world that hated me, right? And that naturally it taught me to hate myself. So when you say wounded, I think about this world that you were born into and the injuries and the harm that you experienced that wounded you. But there's a transition to the Phyllis that I know that is healing, that is helping others heal. How does that happen?
Because I had to learn from a woman by the name of Billy Ayers, I think is her name. She lived in Atlanta, and she was the founder of a Black Woman's Health Project. You already know, Dr. Batts, that health is, you know, where it's at, right? Focusing on health. So a long, long, long time ago, Billy had a program in Atlanta, Black Woman's Health Project. And she came to Iowa, which is where I was living at the time, and she facilitated a workshop because I was part of a group called Women Against Racism, and we were trying to figure out how to be women against racism. So she came and did a workshop, and we busy trying to figure out how to be women against racism, and she was like, "Hold up. How about you figure out how to be women against internalized racism?" And that's when I learned.
And you're talking the 80s or so?
And that's when I learned about this concept that, yes, we're pushing back against not being able to get employment. We're pushing back about not being able to get housing because of the color of our skin. But we've not noticed what we've internalized with respect to the misinformation about who we are. We've not noticed that we've internalized that we're stupid, that we're ugly, that we're irresponsible, that we're sexually promiscuous, blah, 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 that we've not really grappled with how all those stereotypes that are out there floating around, sometimes ambiguously, sometimes very clearly, how all that misinformation seeps into our psyche and affects the way that we see ourselves and affects the way we live our lives. I was blown away. I was like, say what? I have been on that journey of excavating the internalized junk that against my will about myself I have taken in. And you never get to the bottom of it because more keeps coming.
More keeps coming. So what is your advice, right, to the little Black girl in Chicago that has to look up at the screen or her phone and see these images and feel that harm and those injuries?
Yeah. We got to hope for some adults in that little Black girl's life. Because children can't raise themselves. I'm a firm believer in that.
I mean, you had children, adults, though. We all had adults. Mama Bats loved me, but she couldn't compete with the streets.
Right, right. But there must have been some adult in your life. I mean, I know there was adults in my life. That high school teacher, that white male high school teacher, he put me on a trajectory. My life, I am responsible for the trajectory of liberation that I'm on because of him.
Mm.
White male history teacher. I am so sad that I don't remember his name and that I never got back to tell him the influence he had on my life.
And it probably wasn't just you, right?
I don't know what was going on. I was very self.
But I'm saying when we influencers, when we're that adult that is impacting people, it's oftentimes more than one person, even though we don't know it, they don't get back to tell us. So are you saying that there's a duty to do that, or that people have a role? White male teachers have a role in the liberation of young black girls?
They can. Absolutely. They did in my life. Absolutely. If you are bringing the truth, it wasn't even his point of view. I don't know what he thought.
He showed the video,
though.
He was
just doing his job.
The video was not bad.
Right, right. He was just doing his job. And in doing his job and doing it well, not sleeping through it, you know, he wasn't that teacher that kicked back and said, I don't care what you do, I still get paid. He wasn't that teacher.
Mm-hmm.
He showed up, prepared, and did his job. So, you know, yeah, if you just tell the truth, seek the truth, do your job, be present, call out, interrupt, then yes, you are doing work that will be liberatory for somebody.
That's easier said than done. I mean, oftentimes people lack the courage to do their job. I don't even think it's laziness. I think it's fear, truthfully. I mean, because when you do your job, you put a spotlight on yourself. When you show up, you become a target.
True.
Know? So you talked about Iowa. And then you mentioned Tennessee. Where are the places you have lived, and what has life been like in those places?
Born in Chicago, went to school, undergrad in Peoria, Illinois.
Okay.
I moved back to Chicago, worked in the suburbs, moved to Iowa, lived there for 10 years, and then moved to Pennsylvania, lived there for 30 years, and now I'm in Tennessee for about 2.25 years, something like that. So what was the question?
Well, I'll ask you this. Where is home and why?
I was in Chicago last month, and that felt like home.
Wow.
Oh, and I forgot. I lived in Maryland for a couple of years.
I thought you were just blocking that one out because I knew about Maryland. So I wasn't going to challenge you. But I'm like that.
I must have blocked it out.
Yeah, I wasn't going to challenge you. But I said she done skipped over the whole state of Maryland on the way to Tennessee. So.
Yeah. I literally forgot.
Okay.
So when I was there, it felt like home. I was happy to see my family, my extended family that included cousins. I was happy to see my sister. I was happy to see my brother. When I go to Chicago, I go back to my ancestral home where I lived for however many years, you know, owned by my parents. I would not move back to Chicago, but it feels like home when I am there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what about Iowa? What comes to mind when you think about Iowa?
Iowa was a nice respite from the trials and tribulations of life. I was there for 10 years doing a not hard job and had great friends. My children were getting probably a decent education, if not a great education, but they were going to be the only black kids in their class. And I didn't want them to have that life, so I moved.
I remember I was keynoting a conference in Des Moines, I believe, and I called you because I was concerned there weren't going to be any black people in Iowa.
More so now, but yeah.
Yeah, I didn't see many, but I wasn't the only one in the room.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see any at the airport. I found that to be terrifying, but it was okay when I got to the conference. So you said you lived in Pennsylvania for 30 years. Tell us about Pennsylvania.
Where I lived was Allentown, Pennsylvania, and it was always going upstream in Allentown. You were always going upstream. You know, in Iowa, you could kind of chill, you know, row your boat, it was chill. But to Allentown, you are always going upstream. And I think it was the gap between what I expected and what it was, because I thought of Pennsylvania as going east. You know, I had, you know, Chicago, Peoria, Iowa, that's all Midwest, solidly Midwest. But then when I moved to Allentown, which is like an hour from Manhattan, hour and a half, I was like, I'm on the East Coast. This is the cutting edge, you know. I am with the avant-garde and all that kind of stuff. But Allentown is not that. And so I think that disappointment kind of set me up, you know, because I thought I was, I think Manhattan is East Coast. Allentown is not. So
upstream, I mean, say more about that. You're talking about like the salmon?
I mean to say you're always fighting. You're always working against something. It's not ever flowing your way. You got to work against the way things are flowing.
So you fought for 30 years.
I fought for 30 years, and then I made the decision, I'm not dying here, and so I moved.
So
I'm not giving in my death.
In closing, what is your I mean, we got to the good stuff. We're going to have a part two of this. What is your hope for Allentown or places like it for the fight? Like, and I know you're not here, so you can say, I don't give a damn about Allentown. But I'm saying, like, you've left a lot of people that you love and whose lives you have impacted. What is your hope for places and people that struggle, you know, your dream for Allentown?
My dream for Allentown and in general is that when something is broken, you either nourish it or you compost it. So Allentown either needs to be about nourishing so that it is better, or burn it down. Compost that. Compost those relationships. Compost those organizations. Compost that housing. Compost that education system. You either nourish it or you end it.
This is coming from a woman that worked within the city of Allentown proper, the government, for how long?
I worked for the city for about 12 years in two different tours. And I just want to give credit to the Nourish or Compost. Her name is Adrienne Marie Brown. You know who I'm talking about? But anyway, I just want to mention her name, Adrienne Marie Brown.
That's her language.
That's her language.
Phyllis, it has been an honor to know you, an honor to be in relationship with you, an honor to speak to you and with you, and I look forward to continuing to nourish our relationship, because that's what you do. I mean, you never gave me that language before, but that's how I receive you, is you nourish things or you step away from them.
That is true. Hey, look at that.
thank you for taking this call. Thank you for sharing yourself. And again, we're going to do a part two of this, because there's so much more to discuss, but it has been a pleasure.
Anytime. Take care.
You've been listening to Let's Talk. This is Dr. Hassan Batts. Have a great day.